for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Many children who have a seizure never have another, but for some, it's the first of many. For these children and their parents, managing the disorder can be a challenge. Joining me in the studio to talk about what treatments are available for children with epilepsy and how parents can help them cope, Joan Austin. She's Distinguished Professor Emerita at Indiana University School of Nursing. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. Dr. Eric Kossoff is Associate Professor of Neurology and Pediatrics at Johns Hopkins University Hospital. Good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us by phone from Fort Worth, Texas, Dr. Angel Hernandez, Medical Director of the Comprehensive Epilepsy Program at Cook Children's Healthcare System. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you.
And throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Dr. Kossoff, if I could start with you, how common are seizures among children?
So, Diane, it's actually very common. We see probably about 1 in 200 children will have had seizures at some point in their life. As you mentioned, many of them can outgrow their seizures. They hit puberty older than that and outgrow them, but there are definitely many who become intractable.
Do we know what percentage become intractable?
In children, probably about 30%.
Really?
About 70% do wonderful. Medicines control their seizures and they outgrow them, or they may remain on medicine for a long time but still be under control.
What kinds of medications?
What we call anticonvulsant medicines. So these are medicines designed for children and adults with seizures, and it raises the threshold, makes a seizure less likely to happen.
Dr. Hernandez, how much do we know about the causes of these seizures? What's going on in the brain?
Well, unfortunately, about 70% of patients, we still don't find a reason for their seizures, which is a big question we get from parents. And, of course, it's very frustrating not to know the reasons for their seizures. The other 30%, we are able to find reasons, which could be, for example, brain tumors or malformations of the brain, and could be infections of the brain as well. The other 70% of patients that we don't find a reason, we still suspect that there is a genetic condition that those children are born with that could be the cause of their condition. But unfortunately, we don't have this day and age the testing available to identify those patients.
And what about the manifestations of these seizures? How are they different, Dr. Hernandez?
They can present in two ways. One, they're the focal seizures, meaning that they're coming from one area in the brain, and they can manifest from a simple stare where the patient stops and stares and is unresponsive to verbal stimulation. And then you have the other type, which is the generalized seizures, which the whole brain is involved when the seizure starts. And those patients can also vary from what we used to know as the grand mal seizures, or the full-body convulsions, to a simple stare where the children will stare 50 times a day and they are unresponsive and they return to their normal activities, which is one of the most common referrals to for an electroencephalogram or an EEG is the usual staring spells that teachers and parents can see.
And how long might those staring spells last?
Those staring spells may last somewhere between 10 to 20 seconds, sometimes up to 30 seconds.
I see. And turning to you, Joan Austin, I know you've conducted a number of studies on children who have seizures, but you also have a very personal connection.
Yes, I do. Our daughter was 6 years old when she had her first seizure, and it happened in the real early in the morning. She called out very weakly, "Mom," and it sounded strange. And so I went in, and she was convulsing on the whole left side of her body. And so I called the pediatrician. He said, "I'll meet you at the emergency room." And so we were still going to the hospital, she was still having the seizure, and then it stopped. And then we had a second one.
What kind? When you say her left side, what do you mean?
It was jerking. The whole left side was jerking and just convulsing and, you know, sort of a tonic-clonic. And she said, "I can't breathe." So she was awake, and she said, "I can't breathe." And then when we got to the emergency room, she had yet a third seizure. So we had what was called status epilepticus as the onset. And so... But over the next 3 years, she would have seizures periodically. She was placed on phenobarbital, which is at that time, this is a long time ago, and given the diagnosis of epilepsy. Then over the next 3 years, she had seizures about every 3 to 4 months, and we learned to live with epilepsy.
And you said she was 6 years old when
yes.
that began. How common an age, Dr. Kossoff, is that for epilepsy or seizures to begin?
That's probably one of the most common ages. We see a large number of children with sort of school age onset, as we call it, seizures, in the range from 5 to 10 years old. We do see a lot of infants. So there are infants that present with seizures from different causes, younger children, and then certainly teenagers. Teenagers can also present with seizures. One of the most common forms of epilepsy is called JME, or juvenile myoclonic epilepsy, affects teenagers. That's when it starts. A lot depends on the age. Depending on what the age of the child is, helps us to try to figure out what may be the cause. As Dr. Hernandez mentioned, perhaps genetic, perhaps something else.
And when you're dealing with an infant, let's start there. When you're dealing with an infant, would that be a very different presentation from the one that Joan Austin just described?
Absolutely. Infants are one of the toughest populations in terms of knowing what's going on. The neonatologists, the child, the parents, the pediatricians can often see unusual spells and wonder if it's colic or reflux or something.
Because of what's going on.
Well, just infants are confusing. They can't tell you what's going on. Their seizures can look different. The brain hasn't, as we called it, myelinated.
How do they look?
They may stare. They may have some tiny focal twitching. They may just have a decrease in their breathing rate. We'll see that sometimes. So it can be very tricky in infants.
So unless it's happening right there in front of the doctor, a parent can be very confused.
Absolutely. And if there is a suspicion, if the pediatrician says this is not a normal infant perhaps, and we're worried that they have had a brain injury, could they be having seizures now? They have to have an elevated sense of suspicion. And that helps us as neurologists.
Now, Dr. Hernandez, once you see a child or even an infant with this kind of presentation, what's the first thing that you would do?
Well, the first thing in order to get a diagnosis is, of course, a good medical history. We go through from the time of delivery, any complications at the time of delivery, and then if the child has had any developmental problems, which can help us in identifying those specific children that are at risk of having seizures. And, of course, that we want a good description of the events, and we're looking at exactly what was the first thing that the parent noticed on the child, and then we move forward with that. So the first evaluation is a good medical history. And so we need a good history from the parents, again, from the beginning all the way to the end of the event, what happened right after the event as well. And then after that, the next evaluation, which is very important, is an EEG or an electroencephalogram, which measures brainwave activity to help us. Sometimes it doesn't help us, but sometimes it helps us in determining which children are at risk of developing epilepsy if it was the first event. And depending on that, then we will make a decision whether the patient will need an MRI of the brain, which will give us a better picture of the brain to see whether there's something they didn't develop normally or there's any other malformation of the brain.
Joan Austin, you must have been a mix of many emotions watching your child.
It was very overwhelming. Even though I had been a nurse and I had worked with seizure patients when it was my daughter, I reacted as a parent. I was so frightened. I can remember sitting in that waiting room and I was shaking so hard I couldn't get my feet on the floor. I was that frightened from that whole experience. And I think just living with it is tough as a parent. Our daughter was confused. She was thinking, erroneously, she came up with the idea from seeing something on TV that she had been poisoned. She saw an ad on TV or a warning about a poisonous gas, and they mentioned seizures. And she started saying, there's poison in my bed and poison on my hand, because her seizures had started in her hand, she said, with electricity. So helping her get through being this frightened about being poisoned and just living with it. But,
and what about the whole genetic factor? Did you have to undergo examination to determine if there were genetics?
You know, this was over 30 years ago, and no, when we had no history in the family. And it's actually gone very well. She was one of those children that Dr. Kossoff talked about.
How wonderful. Joan Austin, she's Distinguished Professor Emerita at the Indiana University School of Nursing. We'll take just a short break. When we come back, we'll take some of your calls. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're talking about seizures in children. I have three people with me. Dr. Angel Hernandez is medical director of the Comprehensive Epilepsy Program at Cook Children's Healthcare System in Fort Worth, Texas. He's on the phone with us. Dr. Eric Kossoff is associate professor of neurology and pediatrics at Johns Hopkins University Hospital. He is medical director of the Ketogenic Diet Center and director of the Pediatric Neurology Residency Program. And the third person on our panel is Joan Austin. She's Distinguished Professor Emerita at the Indiana University School of Nursing. We're going to open the phone shortly. Joan Austin, I know you've studied this issue. First of all, are all seizures necessarily epileptic seizures, or is that a separate category?
Well, we studied children who had a first seizure, and so generally they have to have two seizures to at least be considered for a diagnosis, and probably Dr. Kossoff could speak more to the diagnosis of that. We study children with seizures, all different kinds, and we're looking at mental health and psychological problems and school problems. And we find that there are higher rates of mental health problems in children with epilepsy, and they do have more learning problems.
Probably very self-conscious going into a schoolroom.
Right. The type of psychological problems are attention problems, primarily inattention, and also more anxiety, depression symptoms, social problems that are associated with it. And in the learning problems, they have some cognitive, sometimes some psychomotor slowing or processing speed slowing. So they have some deficits in cognition. Not all of them, but some of them do.
Now, Dr. Kossoff, the difference, or is there one, between a child who has been diagnosed as having seizures and one who's been diagnosed as an epileptic?
So as Joan mentioned, there's sort of a subtle difference between seizures and epilepsy, and it's more of just the term itself. Epilepsy is more than one seizure. And so you can have a seizure for many reasons. It may not mean that you're going to have more. It may not mean that it was because of genetics or a structural cause, as was mentioned. Epilepsy means you've had repeated seizures, generally means you're at risk to have more seizures at some point in your life. And so those children are treated definitely differently. For a child with a seizure, we do the same recommendations and first testing that Dr. Hernandez mentioned, history, EEG, MRI, but we may not treat. So after a first seizure, as child neurologists, we have a little bit of luxury of time. Children are not driving cars. They're not usually in much danger from a seizure. So after one seizure, we'll get some testing and decide if we want to treat. After they have what we call epilepsy, meaning repeated seizures back to back, as in Joan's daughters and other children, we will then go ahead and treat.
Here's an email from Carrie in Cincinnati, Ohio, regarding the links between brain tumors and epileptic type seizures. I've always wondered about what science knows now, she says. This is what apparently killed my father 5 decades ago. Dr. Hernandez.
Well, we know that there are some brain tumors, depending on their location, that make some people more prone to have seizures. Again, this is brain tumors are causing irritability or just tickling around the normal parts of the brain around the brain tumor, and that can create a seizure. Those are typically tumors that are more on the surface of the brain, different than some tumors that that are more deep in the brain. But certainly we do see some patients with epilepsy that have brain tumors.
And what is it that finally could lead to surgery, Dr. Kossoff?
Well, so, you know, when we treat children and adults, for that matter, with epilepsy, we usually try medicine first, whether it's from a brain tumor or genetic causes, because most of the time medicines work. And there are many medicines out there with some with side effects, some that are relatively free of side effects. So we usually try them first. If you're in a situation for a brain tumor or a brain malformation where you know where the seizures are coming from and it's potentially a safe part of the brain to take out, which takes planning to know that, and the family realizes that it's time, surgery is then offered. Usually if several and several for every child is a little different, but 3 or 4 medicines have been tried, we'll then move forward with surgery to take out the region of the brain where the seizures are coming from.
That's got to be awfully tricky.
It is very tricky. In fact, those are certainly some of the patients that take the most time because there's counseling involved, planning meetings, meeting with the neurosurgeon, and really getting the family and the child often on board with knowing that that's the right decision.
Joan Austin, tell me how long your daughter's seizures lasted.
When she was 12, she had been seizure-free for 3 years, and we took her off medication, and she's been seizure-free since. And I just cannot end without telling you just how well she's turned out. Some 30 years later, she's a college professor. She has a PhD in statistics. She's been married for a number of years, and she has 2 healthy children, 7 and 3.
I'm so glad. The medications that you had her on between the ages of 6 and 9, I guess. Did you find the right medication immediately?
She had breakthrough seizures, but each time they increased the medicine, the seizures would stop. But she did have some side effects of the phenobarbital. She would say, "I know I can work. I'm working too slowly at school." And she was slowed in response. And like a teacher would ask her a question, and she didn't always answer it right away.
I see. But as she then minimized the medication, her responses became quicker.
And as she got older and they weren't increasing it because her seizures had stopped, the side effects were less.
Now, is Joan Austin's daughter one of the lucky ones?
Yes, I think absolutely. Those are the children we love to see. Those are the children that we see maybe once a year, and at some point they come off medicine and go ahead and lead normal lives. Unfortunately, there certainly are some, as you mentioned, unlucky ones who, again, about 30% who do not respond to medicines and may need other options.
And can you tell early on which are going to be the ones who are going to have to continue?
That is an absolutely wonderful question that a lot of researchers are trying to do and say, are there factors that maybe even at that first seizure can tell you who that child is going to be that's intractable, therefore telling this family, look, we need to think about other options, surgery, diet, otherwise, even right from the very beginning. There's good evidence that, as Joan mentioned, status epilepticus can be a risk factor for very difficult to control seizures. A large number of seizures at the very beginning, so a child who has one seizure in a month, is a very different situation than a child who has 100 in a month.
I see.
And then, of course, the cause, a brain tumor, a cortical malformation of the brain, certain kinds of genetic epilepsies that we know are going to be tough to control can very much influence our decision.
Dr. Hernandez, tell me what you believe a parent seeing a child having a seizure should do right away.
Well, first thing they need to do is not to panic. I know that is very hard when you're seeing your child have a seizure for the first time, but you need to concentrate on your child and be sure that he's safe. Make sure that if he has fallen, that he's not fallen on a concrete floor, to basically roll him over on his side. And that is done in order for the saliva to come out on the side of the mouth, and to reassure them. Some people can talk to them, although some may not hear when they're in a seizure. But some children can hear their parents when they're in a seizure. So a lot of reassurance, rolling over on their side. And then if it's a first-time seizure, then an emergency room visit is recommended.
What about that procedure we all used to hear about as youngsters, putting an upside-down teaspoon in the mouth above the tongue?
Yeah,
Dr. Kossoff.
Yeah, we don't recommend that any longer. It's generally not necessary. If you do, as Dr. Hernandez mentioned, most children do fine. The saliva comes out.
And they don't swallow their tongues.
Absolutely
which
not.
Was the right. thing that people used to worry about.
Right.
Here's an email from Tacoma Park. Please talk about the ketogenic diet in treating epilepsy and comment on its applicability for adults whose epilepsy started in childhood. Dr. Kossoff.
So, Diane, when we see children with epilepsy, we almost always try medicines first. Medicines work. There are many different choices, but there are definitely some who are not appropriately treated with medicines. We may offer them surgery. There's another device called a vagus nerve stimulator that's implanted that can help. And then the fourth major option is trying dietary treatments. Dietary treatments actually predate most of the medicines. They go back to 1921. These are high-fat, low-carbohydrate diets. There are variants of the theme, but that's mostly what they do. How these diets work, a lot of people are looking into, whether it's the high fat, the low carb, something more on a cellular level, maybe how these diets work. People are investigating. But we know they work. A little more than half of children who are put on these high-fat, low-carb diets will have a reduction in their seizures, and about 10% will become seizure-free.
Dr. Hernandez, are you using these diets as well?
We are, and like Dr. Kalsoff said, these are patients that we have to select specifically depending on their condition, and if they're not candidates for epilepsy surgery, which can sometimes be at times curative, or they're not candidates for other procedures. But certainly the ketogenic diet is one other way of managing the seizures. I also want to mention that, we've received some patients that come in with the thought that they do not want to start medication because, again, some medications may cause some side effects and they want to go straight to the ketogenic diet. But I want to stress to your listeners that medication is usually the first way to go.
And which are the most popular and effective medications, Dr. Kasso?
Well, they all generally work well. Even phenobarbital, which has been around for a long time, is an effective drug. And we sort of tailor our drugs for children based on their age, their body type, their tastes, their habits. If there are comorbidities, some of our drugs help migraines. So if it helps a migraine and seizures, that might be a nice choice.
And what are the side effects?
Well, as Joan mentioned, cognitive side effects are probably the major ones we
see.
These drugs work on the brain, so they can sometimes cause some, as we call CNS or central nervous system side effects.
Dr. Eric Kasoff at Johns Hopkins University Hospital, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have many callers. I'll open the phones. 800-433-8850. First to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Michelle. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
My daughter is 11 years old, and she's had seizures since she was 1 year old. And the first seizure lasted 45 minutes. But it happened to coincide with an illness and a fever. And so even though it was a long seizure, the doctors and my husband and I were crossing our fingers that it was a febrile seizure, meaning brought on by fever. And most of the children who have febrile seizures do not go on to have epilepsy. Unfortunately, about 2 years after the first seizure, she had another, and then 6 months after that, she had another. And so we were on this pattern where she was having, she didn't have them frequently. They were maybe four or five a year, but she did have status epilepticus where, and I was kind of smiling to myself at the beginning when you said they could last seconds or minutes. We had one seizure that lasted 3 hours. And we typically, when she has a seizure, we have to go directly to the emergency room. And they just try medication after medication. They start with Ativan. They move to phenobarbital. And she will have so much medication in her system, and her respiratory system will be so depressed that they will end up having to intubate her. So that she can continue breathing. So these, every time she has a seizure, it was life-threatening almost every time.
So your question, Michelle.
Well, the reason I'm calling is because I want people to know about something that is working for us. And we tried several different medications. We were on the ketogenic diet for almost 3 years. We had some success with that, but it wasn't 100% successful, and it was very difficult. I want people to understand how hard that diet is. And I don't think you get through it without some psychological cost as well. We are now on a medication called Keppra. And it worked for about a year, and then she started having some breakthrough seizures. Mm. Our doctor prescribed a medication, an adjunct to the Keppra called clobazam, And as far as I know, it is not approved by the FDA yet, but somehow he was able to write us a prescription. We get it from a pharmacy in upstate New York, and we have to pay for it. Our insurance isn't covering it, but she has not had a seizure for 1 year and 2 months, It's the longest that she's ever gone.
Well, I can certainly appreciate your reaching out and looking for other ways to treat this. Dr. Kossoff, are you familiar with the drug she talked about?
Yeah, and your listener brings up some very good points. Certainly, many of the drugs we use are approved in adults. Clobazam, as she mentioned, is not even available in the United States, so you have to get it from Canada or Europe.
I see.
For children or adults, but let's see, 90% of the drugs we use, we are looking at adult data, and they just use them in children afterwards, and we learn from them, and they're great drugs. Keppra, as she mentioned, is an effective drug in kids, too.
Well, Michelle, I want to wish you and your daughter all success and continuing health. Thank you for calling. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at Hewlett.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, NPR's Scott Simon tells us about adopting his daughters from China.
There's no Hallmark card moment when your little girl is put into your arms under the circumstances, because the only world they've known is behind them.
It's the subject of his new memoir. Join us.
And as we continue our discussion about seizures and epilepsy, here's a message from Facebook saying, why on earth would medication be the first option over a change in diet when medications have dangers of side effects? That just seems a bit backwards. What are the advantages, Dr. Hernandez?
Well, I think people need to understand that for the most part, medications are well tolerated in children. Yes, they do have some side effects, and maybe the first medication is not the right medication for the specific condition or the specific child. There's some children that tolerate other medications, and there's some children that do very well. Again, like Dr. Kossoff said, 70% of them will respond to medication, and so and as your other listening or the call-in said, sometimes other methods are very hard to do, like the ketogenic diet, and requires a specific parent, a specific child, and a specific epilepsy condition to treat those patients. So not everybody will will be a good candidate for the ketogenic diet.
Why is that ketogenic diet so difficult, Dr. Kossoff?
Well, it doesn't have to be, Diane. So the diet has been around for a long time, and we're making it easier for many children now. There are internet-based computer programs to create recipes for families. There are ketogenic products now on the market.
Give me an example of a meal, a full day of meals going on the ketogenic diet.
So, you know, a lot of the sort of core things that children will eat, again, are high-fat foods. So heavy whipping cream, butter, oils. Mayonnaise will make up a large component of the diet, but then there's also chicken and steak and shrimp. Fruits and vegetables are allowed on the diet in limited quantities. So parents can kind of mix and match and, again, be very creative, and especially now, again, we have ketogenic mixes and powders that can be used as flour substitutes.
Now, is there a rapid response factor? In other words, would your medication tend to create a difference more quickly than the diet?
Not necessarily. The diet seems to work very quickly in a lot of our studies of children.
Well, then why don't you do as our caller asks?
We're moving in that direction.
Okay.
It is not all natural. It is not healthy. So some families think that a dietary treatment is free of side effects, but the diet can cause elevated cholesterol, can cause some weight loss. It does require dietitian time and effort, requires certainly the families to weigh and measure foods. But there are some situations, some epilepsies, one specifically called infantile spasms, where if it's a baby, the child can be given a ketogenic formula very quickly. And so we're starting to use the diet first line in that situation.
Interesting. And I know you, Joan, want to mention a link to the Epilepsy Foundation.
Yes. If you look back 30 years now, there's so many more resources for families than there were for me back then. And the epilepsyfoundation.org, their website now this year has a new site just for parents whose children are newly diagnosed, because that's usually the most difficult year for families, is just that very beginning seizure onset and learning to live with it for the first time.
And that website is
epilepsyfoundation.org. They also have an 800 number. It's 1-800-332-1000.
I'm glad. Thank you for that. Let's go now to, before we do that, somebody asked about putting adults on the ketogenic
diet. I neglected to complete that. I know this is a session on childhood epilepsy, but adults are also a population that can have very difficult to control seizures. And up until very recently, we're not often offered the ketogenic diet. It was seen as just too restrictive for a functional adult to be able to do.
Yeah, I think I could do that. Meat, chicken, a few fruits, whipped cream, butter.
Well, we've heard that from families, and they certainly seem that they can do this diet. We've started to use the Atkins diet for adults and teenagers.
Oh, I see.
As less restrictive. You don't have to weigh and measure the foods. And it offers another choice for adults that don't have a choice before.
Interesting.
So we're looking at that.
All right. Let's go to Spring Lake, Michigan. Good morning, Pamela.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
My daughter is now 5 years old, and she had her first seizure somewhere around 18 months. We were told that they were just febrile seizures. There were no tests or anything done. She now has her seizures, instead of getting better, where there was less, it was more. They were, the duration and the intensity, everything was worse as time went on. So I finally kind of pushed and demanded the pediatrician to get us to a neurologist. So we went in, had all the tests done. She has a lesion on her brain, and they're not sure if it was caused by the seizures or if the seizures caused the lesion. We have tried three medications and a combination of all three of those medications. Nothing's working. We're going in for a 72-hour EEG to kind of figure out where they're all coming from, I guess, in, the very beginning of going down the road of surgery. And I don't know about the lesion, I guess, is my question, maybe, if anyone can address that. If maybe, if somebody had paid attention earlier, maybe that would have made a difference.
So what you're asking is, could the seizures themselves have created the lesions on the brain?
Right, or did the lesion just kind of cause these seizures?
Right.
If we had had earlier testing, if it would have made a difference to
Dr. Kossoff.
Yeah, in general, usually seizures don't cause lesions or brain injury. They can cause something called hippocampal sclerosis, sort of a scarring of the hippocampus in some studies. But in most likelihood for this child, again, without knowing what lesion this is, I can't say too much, but most likely the lesion has been there and started to cause the seizures. Febrile seizures, as she mentioned, as the other caller did as well, are very common. So one out of every 30 children will have a seizure just due to fever. It's benign. We don't do testing. It goes away, usually by age 5.
But if she had repeated seizures, clearly some further examination should have taken place, Dr. Hernandez.
That's correct. You know, again, like Dr. Kossoff said, and not knowing exactly the lesion that we're talking about is hard to make any recommendation, but certainly it sounds like they're going to the epilepsy surgery evaluation route, and I think that's the right way to do this.
Pamela, good luck to you. Thanks for calling. To Glenn, who's in South Florida, you're on the air.
First off, thank you so much for bringing epilepsy out of the shadows, and to your staff for basically spending their lives trying to reduce or even find a cure for epilepsy. Some of you might actually know what I do. I am known as the Destiny Maker cyclist who recently just finished a Miami to Alaska bike ride raising epilepsy awareness and meeting many families around North America who have lost children to SUDEP and other situations with epilepsy. Mine happens to be my son has been having epilepsy since the age of 2. Now 16, he's been seizure-free for a year. He's been on Tegretol and Lyrica. When should these medicines begin to be reduced?
Dr. Kossoff.
Great question, and I applaud him for his efforts as a fellow bicycle rider. That's an impressive ride.
Right.
Usually our goals are to get children seizure-free, of course, but also potentially medication-free. So if generally a child is doing well, is seizure-free for 2 years, we'll often repeat the EEG, and then if it's normal, slowly try to wean the medicines one at a time. And we can often be successful, especially again in children. It's a little different for adults who are driving who may not want to take that risk.
Would you put that same child on that diet as you draw down the medication?
It depends. Probably not. You know, if this child was doing well and is seizure-free, may not need the diet.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe is cured, does not need to be on medicine anymore or any therapy.
Glenn, let's hope that that's the situation with your son.
Thank you so much. He's doing great. He started 11th grade today, and I could not be more proud of the silent example that he gives every day of his life for other children who are suffering the same.
Thanks so much for calling. To Linda, who's in Ithaca, New York. Good morning to you. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Hi. I have to tell you that I have a problem. I'm addicted to listening to your show.
Oh, that's a nice addiction.
This is very exciting. It's the first time I've ever done this. So I come to this actually from an interest in celiac disease, which my daughter and probably son and husband have, and I've become somewhat of an expert at it. I have a PhD in child development, but it's not totally relevant. And I called with this question before you all talked about diet. But obviously gluten is a diet factor that's at the center of celiac. And there are many problems that are associated with celiac disease and potentially other gluten intolerances, including neuropathies and epilepsy in particular. And we know that gluten intolerance is vastly underdiagnosed, that it's only the tip of the iceberg, like maybe 3% of people who by screening tests are actually shown to be celiac, not to mention the potential 30% of the human race that are gluten intolerant in some form. So I guess my question here is, what do you think of the possibility that the reason these ketogenic diets work is potentially the same reason the Atkins diet worked, is that wheat is such a predominant part of our Western diet?
Great question. It comes up quite a bit when I speak about the diet. Parents ask, could this be due to gluten? My child has celiac, in those situations. And we don't think that that seems to be the trigger. There are certainly children with celiac disease who can have seizures. That's been reported. And absolutely, those children, if they go on gluten-free diets, maybe not even need the extent of the ketogenic or modified Atkins diet, can be cured of their epilepsy. But usually it's a different story. These are children who have a known trigger. They say, every time I have gluten, it causes a seizure. They're often normal. Their EEGs can often be normal. It's a different story we get from these families. Again, getting to what Dr. Hernandez said about always getting the history, that can give us a clue that it might be a celiac disease.
Exactly. Thanks for calling, Linda. And to Phoenix, Arizona, John, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for the years of great, intelligent programming. I really love the show. I'm a 911 dispatcher for the Phoenix Fire Department, and I'd say we probably get about 20 to maybe 40 febrile seizure calls a day. Our main response for those, you know, obviously it's a very chaotic situation. Our main response is to get a wet towel and start cooling the baby down, because, you know, usually the fire truck has about a 3 to 4 minute response. I'm just wondering if maybe there's anything else that I can provide for these parents. Another question is that baby actually breathing during that time?
Dr. Hernandez.
Well, I think you're doing the right thing. The first thing on a treatment for febrile seizures is to reduce the temperature. The next step, if by the time you arrive to the home, the child is still in a seizure, that will be your first response. And then secondly will be to give a medication, which I'm sure takes you some time to get to the house, usually less than 10 minutes in most places. So that will be given a medication to stop the seizure. Certainly there are, for those patients that are in a seizure at the time that you arrive, it is most likely that they are breathing. Maybe they have shallow breaths because they're in the middle of a seizure. But for the most part, most children are breathing, but not effectively. So those patients do not need to be intubated initially. The first thing is, again, responding to the temperature. And eventually those patients will get instructions from their pediatrician or their neurologist to be more aggressive in the future when they have a fever, basically alternating acetaminophen and ibuprofen around the clock when they get a fever, and have them checked out by their pediatrician.
But tell me, Dr. Hernandez, how do you get medication into a child who's having a seizure?
Sure. There are many ways they can do it. It depends on the EMS medical director locally. You can have medications that are given by rectum, or you can give medications that are given nasally, or you can give medications intramuscularly, so it goes directly into the muscle. So there are many ways before they actually start working on an intravenous line to give those type of medications. So again, that's going to depend on the medical director of the EMS program at local.
John, thank you for your call and for your service. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to Salt Lake City, Utah. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Diane. This is actually first-time caller. My boy, at the age of 2, had his first grand mal seizure, and over the next 4 or 5 months, he was gradually increased to 20 to 30 grand mal seizures a day. We went through 3 or 4 of the medications. Nothing worked. We were prescribed the ketogenic diet, and the day he started the diet, the seizure stopped. We could tie any seizure afterwards to when he snitched food that he was not supposed to take. We locked our kitchen down. We had doors that we had the only access to. When the callers describe that the diet is difficult, it is difficult. But we are now 3 years seizure-free. We are off the diet and off any medications that he was on.
Oh, what a great story, Mike. I'm so happy. And your child is now how old?
He is 9 years old.
And does he still try to get into those cabinets where he shouldn't be?
You know, it's actually funny. He does not eat a lot of sugary foods. Even today, he does not If he's offered a cookie, he will say no.
Well, you've done a great job, and I congratulate you. Give our very best to your son. That must make you feel awfully good, Dr. Kossoff.
That's a wonderful story, and that's sort of why we're here, you know, is to help kids like that, and certainly why we use the diet so often. When it has that kind of a response, needless to say, it makes us all very, very happy.
Where is this diet published?
It's well used. Dr. Hernandez, as mentioned, uses it in Texas. It's used almost every major city.
But is it on the web anywhere?
Absolutely. So the probably the best resources for families is the Charlie Foundation. So charliefoundation.org.
And is it IE or EY?
IE.
Okay.
And that's a parent support group for the diet.
That's great. Dr. Eric Kossoff of Johns Hopkins University Hospital, Dr. Angel Hernandez of Cook Children's Healthcare System in Fort Worth, Texas, Joan Austin, Distinguished Professor Emerita at Indiana University School of Nursing. Thank you all.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.